Chapter 9. His wife returned late at night. She came in on tiptoe, but he heard her, opened his eyes, and made haste to close them again. She wished to send Jerasim away, and to sit with him herself, but he opened his eyes and said, "No, go away. Are you in great pain?"
"Always the same."
"Take some opium." He agreed and took some. She went away. Till about 3 in the morning he was in a state of stupefied misery. It seemed to him that he and his pain were being thrust into a narrow, deep black sack, but though they were pushed further and further and they could not be pushed to the bottom. And this, terrible enough in itself, was accompanied by suffering. He was frightened yet wanted to fall through the sack, he struggled but yet cooperated. And suddenly he broke through, fell, and regained consciousness. Jerasim was sitting at the foot of the bed dozing quietly and patiently, while he himself lay with his emaciated stockinged legs resting on Jerasim's shoulders. The same shaded candle was there and the same unceasing pain.
"Go away, Jerasim," he whispered.
"It's all right, sir. I'll stay a while."
"No, go away."
He removed his legs from Jerasim's shoulders, turned sideways onto his arm, and felt sorry for himself. He only waited till Jerasim had gone into the next room, and then restrained himself no longer but wept like a child. He wept on account of his helplessness, his terrible loneliness, the cruelty of man, the cruelty of God, and the absence of God. "Why hast thou done all this? Why hast thou brought me here? Why dost thou torment me so terribly?" He did not expect an answer and yet wept, because there was no answer and could be none. The pain again grew more acute, but he did not stir and did not call. He said to himself, "Go on. Strike me. But what is it for? What have I done to thee? What is it for?" Then he grew quiet and not only ceased weeping, but even held his breath and became all attention. It was as though he were listening not to an audible voice, but to the voice of a soul, to the current of thoughts arising within him.
"What is it you want?"
was the first clear conception capable of expression in words that he heard.
"What do you want? What do you want?"
he repeated to himself.
"What do I want?"
"To live and not to suffer," he answered. And again he listened with such concentrated attention that even his pain did not distract him.
"To live? How?" asked his inner voice.
"Why, to live as I used to, well and pleasantly."
"As you lived before, well and pleasantly?"
the voice repeated. And in imagination he began to recall the best moments of his pleasant life. But strange to say, none of those best moments of his pleasant life now seemed at all what they had then seemed, none of them except the first recollections of childhood. There, in childhood, there had been something really pleasant, with which it would be possible to live if it could return. But the child who had experienced that happiness existed no longer. It was like a reminiscence of somebody else. As soon as the period began, which had produced the present Ivan Ilyich, all that had then seemed joys now melted before his sight, and turned into something trivial and often nasty. And the further he departed from childhood and the nearer he came to the present, the more worthless and doubtful were the joys. This began with the school of law. A little that was really good was still found there. There was light-heartedness, friendship, and hope. But in the upper classes there had already been fewer of such good moments. Then during the first years of his official career, when he was in the service of the governor, some pleasant moments again occurred. They were the memories of love for a woman. Then all became confused, and there was still less of what was good. Later on again there was still less that was good, and the further he went the less there was. His marriage, a mere accident, then the disenchantment that followed it, his wife's bad breath and the sensuality and hypocrisy, then the deadly official life and those preoccupations about money, a year of it, and 2, and 10, and 20, and always the same thing. And the longer it lasted the more deadly it became. It is as if I had been going downhill, while I imagined I was going up. And that is really what it was. I was going up in public opinion, but to the same extent life was ebbing away from me. And now it is all done and there is only death.
Then what does it mean?
Why? It can't be that life is so senseless and horrible.
But if it really has been so horrible and senseless, why must I die and die in agony? There is something wrong. Maybe I did not live as I ought to have done, it suddenly occurred to him. But how could that be, when I did everything properly? He replied, and immediately dismissed from his mind this, the sole solution of all the riddles of life and death, as something quite impossible. Then what do you want now? To live? Live how? Live as you lived in the law courts, when the usher proclaimed the judge is coming, the judge is coming, the judge. He repeated to himself. Here he is, the judge. But I am not guilty. He exclaimed angrily. What is it for? And he ceased crying, but turning his face to the wall continued to ponder on the same question, why, and for what purpose, is there all this horror? But however much he pondered he found no answer. And whenever the thought occurred to him, as it often did, that it all resulted from his not having lived as he ought to have done, he at once recalled the correctness of his whole life, and dismissed so strange an idea,